Before we begin with our second case of the day, my notes tell me that we have some students from Fox Valley Technical College here. If that is correct, would they and their teachers stand, please? Very good. Thank you very much. You may be seated. The students are here with a program called Court with Class, which the Supreme Court operates in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So they've received materials about the case that you are going to be arguing to us today. And after the case is over, one of the justices will come and speak with you all if you are able to stay at the conclusion of the case. Now, we've had a little bit of a look at you, and so let me introduce the court to the students and others who are present for the argument. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to Justice Ziegler, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. On her left, Justice Michael Gableman. And at the far end of the bench, Justice Dan Kelly. So with those introductions done, I will call our second case, which is States versus Samzow. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, Attorney Tom Aquino representing the petitioner, Glenn Samzow. Today I will be arguing that the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment applies at suppression hearings for three overlapping reasons.
Okay, let me get my speaker.
You know, the microphone, I'm having a very hard time hearing you. My speaker here is not working at my desk, which is one of the problems, but maybe adjusting the podium might be a little bit of a help. See if that works out a little bit better.
Okay, testing.
Yeah, I think that's better. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. As I was saying, I will be arguing that the Confrontation Clause applies for three overlapping reasons. First, the Supreme Court has already held that the Public Trial Clause of the Sixth Amendment applies at suppression hearings, because often when the exclusionary rule is at play, the suppression hearing is the trial, both in form and function. In addition, both the defendant and the public benefits when government officials are subjected to the, quote, salutary effects of public scrutiny. Denying confrontation would be inconsistent with this precedent because it would not recognize the importance of the suppression hearing, and it would allow officials to escape public scrutiny. The second reason is that the history of the exclusionary rule demonstrates that the suppression hearing is properly thought of as an extension of the trial. The exclusionary rule was originally litigated at trial and migrated pretrial simply as a matter of judicial convenience. It wasn't until the 1970s, for example, that the federal rule required suppression hearings to be held pretrial. And the third reason is the special nature of the exclusionary rule and its important role in deterring the executive branch from violating important constitutional rights. Denying confrontation will undermine the deterrence effect of the exclusionary rule by allowing government officials to, again, evade public scrutiny and thus accountability through submission of unsworn police reports. So for these reasons, we are asking the court to maintain the status quo and hold that the Confrontation Clause does apply at suppression hearings.
I have a question. Is it your position that you're arguing that the Confrontation Clause applies to all suppression hearings, regardless of the nature of the issue at the suppression hearing? Because you've got a very special case here. In this case, if there is no suppression, and this is what would be suppressed is whether the police officer had reasonable suspicion to stop the car, right?
Yes.
If there was reasonable suspicion to stop the car, then any evidence relating to the drunkenness would come in, right?
If the stop was reasonable.
That's right. So if there's a holding here that the stop was reasonable, then at trial, that issue would not ever be raised again, whether there was reasonable suspicion to stop. What the issue at trial would be is there were enough evidence to convict him of drunk driving. Was there a sobriety test in the field? Was there breathalyzer, was there a blood test, right?
Correct.
All right. So counsel, if you don't allow the defendant to challenge at suppression, he never challenges. He can never challenge it again.
Correct.
All right. So that's very special. Take, for example, a confession. You have a suppression hearing on whether the confession is voluntary,
right,
intelligent, and knowing, right?
Right.
Okay. The court says don't suppress at the suppression hearing. It now goes to trial, and at trial, the state brings in the confession, right?
Right.
Doesn't the defendant have a right to go to the jury and say it's not voluntary?
Yes, at that point.
Right. So even if you say the defendant can't do it in the suppression hearing, the defendant doesn't have the right to cross-examine at the confession hearing, the defendant gets a shot at it during trial. Right?
In some cases, yes.
In some cases. That's why I'm saying to you that in this case it's very special, because once you do not give the defendant the right at the suppression hearing to confront witnesses, the defendant never can confront the witness in your kind of case here, which is different than the confession case and maybe other cases. I only thought of the confession case. So you have to be careful, it seems to me, to argue in this case and not expect the court to argue in other cases about suppression and confrontation, because in different situations.
Well, I appreciate that distinction. I would just say that there may be cases, even there may be lots of different cases where the facts where there might be an opportunity at trial to cross-examine, but that's not going to be any
case. But that's not here.
That's certainly not the case here. There was
And that's
no
the best case you got for your argument.
Well, yes. I mean, this case is a good example why if you don't have a right to confront, you never have a right to confront.
Right. That's why I'm saying to you, you've got the best case that I can think of, and here it is. Say no confrontation. What's testimonial? Yeah, that's what another thing I don't understand.
Well, what's testimonial here, right, is that there's an officer is engaged in a state action, a police action, has pulled over the defendant, and as this isn't just chit chat. This is him saying the reason I pulled you over was because you crossed the center line. Now, he's being recorded. This is similar to any police interrogation where there's questions asked. The officer doesn't necessarily have to be saying the truth at that point. Could be hoping to solicit some kind of admission. Maybe he's not sure whether there was the crosses of the center line. The video suggests that there wasn't a cross of the center line. Certainly the defendant's, Mr. Zamzow's response or any witness's response in that case when being asked by an officer would potentially be testimony. But here again, it's because he's being, the officer's being recorded, and the reason for the recording is to preserve evidence for a future case. So it's very similar to a police report, which would be considered testimonial.
Counsel, I want to go back to this procedural question of the suppression hearing versus taking part in the trial. I was having a little difficulty hearing Justice Abrahamson's questions, so if I repeat that, just tell me and I'll listen to the recording later. Is it my understanding that one has an option of doing a suppression hearing versus addressing the question at trial itself?
Well, it depends on the procedure. For I don't know in the federal rules, for example, there's both a requirement that there be a disclosure of evidence that might be used through the that was gained through suppression or through a that might be subject to suppression motion, but also a requirement that it be a suppression motion be filed pretrial. As a rules 12 and 41 of the federal code, there isn't, as I'm aware of, a similar Wisconsin rule.
Right. This was a matter of prudence, right? We decided that we would take this procedure out of the trial context and address it separately outside of the presence of the jury. We do it before the trial. This is a suppression hearing, right? That's a matter of prudence.
Right, because it often is dispositive why impanel a jury if there's not going to be any evidence.
And there's no constitutional aspect to that, is that correct? I mean, there is no requirement that it be done separately, and it doesn't violate any constitutional provision to do it separately.
Correct. The Supreme Court has not said either way that it, as a matter of constitutionality, that it must be raised either pretrial or at trial. Some states that have said that that have said that there isn't a suppression right there isn't a confrontation right at the suppression hearing has done so, saying because in some circumstances you can actually raise it at trial, for example.
All right. So let's adjust the facts just a slight amount. Let's say this occurred during the trial, and there was a question about the admission of this evidence. Would that change the analysis at all? Would that necessarily mean that there is a right to confront witnesses with respect to the admission of that piece of evidence?
Right. Well, under a scenario where, say through trial, through cross-examination, it was determined that the arresting officer didn't really observe any poor driving and only pulled the defendant over for a hunch that proved to be correct, then theoretically, an objection could be made based under the exclusionary rule. And that's how the exclusionary rule first came up, both in the federal and the state system in Weeks and in Hoyer here in Wisconsin. It was first made as a trial objection. And there were later court decisions from the 1920s in Wisconsin, State v. Warfield, and in the U.S. system, or in the federal U.S. Supreme Court system, the U.S. v. Gould, G-O-U-L-E-D, the court noted that while there was a preference for these issues to be raised pre-trial for convenience, if it came up in the course of trial, it was a proper objection.
Okay. So what we're talking about here, of course, is not the adjudication of guilt, turning on this question. We're talking about the admission of evidence and determining whether it's admissible based on its compliance with constitutional requirements.
Correct.
All right. So now my understanding is that there are exceptions to the confrontation clause with respect to that question. For example, when you're dealing with a confidential informant, is that correct?
Right. The court has said that the law of privileges is not superseded by the confrontation clause. So, for example, the informant privilege is a recognized evidentiary privilege. The privilege against self-incrimination, for example, is another one that would not be trumped by the confrontation clause.
And what is the rationale for that?
I'm not sure exactly that I've seen an articulation of the rationale, other than that at the common law, the privilege. It was understood that the confrontation right, that norm would override the law of privilege because there was a law of privilege. There were areas where cross-examination would not be allowed.
Okay, so, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the nature of the conflict in these proposed rules. So you are saying that the confrontation clause gives you a constitutional right to either cross-examine the officer or his testimony is excluded, whereas we have created a statutory or a rule-based privilege that you say trumps the constitutional right to confrontation. How does, if the confrontation clause really does require that you be able to cross-examine a witness for the purpose of admission of testimony, how is it that a rule or a statute can override that?
I again, I'm not as familiar with, you know, cases discussing the interplay of the Confrontation Clause and the law of privilege. But my understanding is that because, you know, that the right to cross-examination does not include the right to override evidentiary privileges, however they're developed, whether it's through statute or through the common law, you know, whether it's the attorney-client privilege, whether it's, you know, the priest-penitent privilege or whatever privilege may be in effect or at issue.
Sounds like it goes to the concept that there's no right that's absolute, that every right, including confrontation, might have exceptions, like the free expression, free religion. They're all exceptions.
Right.
I don't know the answer to Justice Kelly's question.
What would you have us do with State versus Frams?
Well, in State versus Frams, that just involved an evidentiary issue. It did not involve the exclusionary rule, which is what we think is a distinguishing factor. In Frams, that involved, you know, whether a certain hearsay exception applied at the time. And we're not saying that the Confrontation Clause applies in pretrial hearings just involving evidentiary issues. We're limiting it to hearings litigating the exclusionary rule.
Was Frams before or after Crawford?
Frams was before Crawford. And
I have a question. Suppose you had this suppression hearing in the trial. I'm going back to Justice Kelly's question. Suppose you have this suppression hearing as part of the trial, right?
Yes.
You wouldn't do it in front of you wouldn't have that hearing in front of a jury, would you?
No.
You'd have to get rid of the you'd have to excuse the jury. Have a hearing.
Right, that's because you don't want the jury to potentially hear this evidence that wouldn't come into trial.
That's right. So, but you have a jury right to trial, right?
Yes.
So, suppression hearing is not part of trial. Because the jury's gone.
Sure, but there's also bench trials.
Okay. Yeah, but we're talking about the fact finder. And the fact finder being the jury. So even if it was during the trial, if you're assuming you have a jury, you'd have to get rid of the jury, so it's really not part of the trial that the jury is going to hear, the suppression hearing.
No, it's not part of that trial, but it occurs during the trial, and the
sure.
And the evidence about, you know, whether the evidence was gathered legally may come through, you know, when the jury is there.
But it's arguable that anything that happens that relates to the trial is the trial. So suppression, you can argue, is the trial, whether it's pre-trial, during trial, or, can't think of an example, after trial.
Right, and the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the public trial clause applies at suppression hearings suggests that this, you know, that we should take an expanded view of these rights.
Are you arguing Justice Riley's dissent, essentially, that the prosecution involves both the suppression hearing and the trial? That a prosecution is broader than just your right to a trial?
Right. So we're referring to the language of the Sixth Amendment saying that all of those clauses apply through criminal prosecutions. Yes, that is. There's support for our position in the text of the amendment.
Do you have any historical evidence to support your interpretation of the Confrontation Clause that its original meaning encompassed pretrial hearings? I can give you a better idea of what I'm looking for. In Crawford, Justice Scalia went through in great detail the history of and the original meaning of the Sixth Amendment. But, of course, that case and no other United States Supreme Court case has decided the precise issue before this court today. So when I'm asking you for historical evidence, I'm looking for something akin to what Justice Scalia used in his opinion to support the Crawford decision.
Right. Well, no. The suppression hearing is a recent phenomenon. It wasn't in existence at the time of the founding. There is case law. The language in some of the post-Crawford cases discuss how confrontation was just a fundamental, was viewed as a fundamental property of our adversarial system of law. And so, for example, in the Melendez case, the court writes that, the famous example of when Sir Walter Raleigh was convicted just based on affidavit, it was because it was so unusual that it created this outcry, this response to it. So I don't know specifically what kind of pretrial hearings existed at the time of the founding or the adoption of the Confrontation Clause, and to the extent to which there were rights to cross-examine at that time.
What, if any, import in your analysis is the fact, apparently, that Officer Burkles died soon after the stop?
Well, for our analysis, all that matters is that he wasn't there. And there was no opportunity to cross-examine.
That comes to mind when I hear of the questions, although stated in a broader sense, how it would apply in this particular case, the questions regarding the suppression hearing could have been held during trial. In this case, sure that's correct, even though it's a hypothetical in this case. Given that he died, what opportunity for cross-examination would there be at trial?
Right, well, there wouldn't have been an opportunity to cross-examine him.
Does that make the inability to cross-examine earlier of greater or less import? Does it make any difference at all in your argument?
No, it doesn't. Because whether he was unavailable because because he died, or because just went to training, or was just not there. The fact of the matter is, there wasn't an opportunity to cross-examine him and to get into what it was that he actually saw that prompted him to initiate the stop. I see my yellow light is on. Just want to touch on a few things. Obviously the state has relied heavily on this court's opinion in O'Brien, which says that there are no confrontation rights during preliminary hearings. And I want to address the fact that a preliminary hearing is much different than a suppression hearing. Preliminary hearing in Wisconsin is totally a statutory creature. The legislature can, frankly, do away with the preliminary hearing, but the legislature cannot prevent the defendant from litigating the exclusionary rule. Also, during a preliminary hearing, credibility is not an issue. It's only plausibility. However, at a suppression hearing, credibility often is the issue. For example, not just in this case about whether there really was reasonable suspicion to pull over the defendant, but in cases involving, say, consent to search. Did the defendant actually give consent or not?
Counsel, that would be true in the confidential informer context too, though, right?
I'm not sure I follow the question.
Well, sure. If the suppression hearing turns on the testimony, out-of-court testimony of a confidential informant, and that does not offend the confrontation clause, we have the same considerations about reliability and opportunities to test observational abilities and so on, right? Those are the same.
Right, and in the McCrae case, the Supreme Court case of McCrae, where the court explained why introducing the confidential informant's statements to the police officers did not violate the confrontation clause, it was because the police officers who made the decision to arrest based on the confidential informant's statements were cross-examined. So you could test the reasonableness of the officer's decision to rely on the statements through cross-examination.
But you couldn't test the reliability of the original observation that he relied on.
No, but that's frankly not relevant at a suppression hearing. The truth of what the confidential informant asserted is not an issue at a suppression hearing. It's all the relevance of the informant's statement is just on the effect of the listener, which in that case would be the police officer. At a trial, however, you know, whether what the informant said about the defendant, you know, whether that often that isn't introduced for the truth of the matter asserted, and so it would be a hearsay violation.
What if the officer had called one of his fellow officers and said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pull this person over because of X, Y, and Z. Officer A dies. Officer B steps in and testifies. This is the basis for having pulled them over. What would the result be?
Well, if that officer, the second officer is cross-examined as to what it was the first officer told him, then I think there wouldn't be a confrontation clause violation.
It would not be a violation.
Right. If the officer who actually made the decision was cross-examined, then the question is, you know, whether it was reliable, whether it was, whether it was reasonable to rely on the first officer's statements under the totality of the circumstances.
All right. So in both situations, what Officer A observed and did would be beyond cross-examination. But in scenario A, it's a confrontation clause violation. In scenario B, it is not.
Yes.
Okay.
So, as I was saying, also another difference with the preliminary hearing is that when there's a preliminary hearing, and say the state or the prosecutor appoints a narrator to review, to read police reports, for example. Once the, that's admissible at preliminary hearing, it's not admissible at trial, and eventually there is that opportunity to cross-examine at the trial.
My name is Warren D. Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. I think you cannot ignore the history. You cannot ignore the history behind the right to confrontation because it informs the nature of the right. And that really is clear in the Crawford opinion itself. And so we have to look at what the confrontation right meant as it was developed, as it was adopted, and as the case law surrounding it for about 120 years developed. And that history has examples of situations that weren't trial in which out-of-court statements were used. And the Marion statutes, which is cited extensively in Crawford, is an example of that. Those, as I understand it, those were used to determine whether or not the case went to the assize for trial. And that was routinely, they relied on hearsay-type statements. The other thing, and
counsel,
perhaps...
Counsel, if I may, though... Crawford is quite clear. It's not talking about reliability.
That's
the
right.
The essence of hearsay, out-of-court statements offered for the truth of the matter asserted, the essence of the hearsay exceptions are that there are sufficient indicia of reliability. Take prior recorded records. You need to have the foundation of it was made by the person after or time of the event recorded. It was made by a person with knowledge. It was made, and so there are four or five different foundational requirements to allow for this out-of-court statement to have sufficient indicia of reliability to be admitted. out-of-court statements with regard to reliability are not what we're talking about. Crawford makes clear it's a procedural rather than a substantive guarantee. It commands not that evidence be reliable. That's not what we're talking about with regard to the Confrontation Clause, but that reliability be assessed in a particular manner. And what is that manner? The ability to confront and cross-examine your witnesses. So I don't follow your historical development. I mean, I follow it to the extent that it gets to Roberts, right? I mean, I used to embrace Roberts, but not anymore, not since Crawford. I still sort of embrace Roberts, but I'm mindful that Crawford is the law. So forget your out-of-court statement history, because that's not what we're dealing with now. Well, how do you respond?
I think the history informs not the reliability, but the nature of the right itself, and the fact that it is traditionally been understood as applying only at trial. And I think perhaps the best example of that is we issue search warrants on affidavit all the time. It seems to me it's pretty much the same thing. The affidavit is going to demonstrate reasonable probable cause, and in this case, the statement is offered to prove reasonable suspicion. So there is this tradition, and has been in both common law and in the United States after the adoption of the amendment, that some things do not require confrontation.
Well, can you challenge the search warrant?
But you can, yes, you can, but you can't go beyond the four corners of the warrant, of the affidavit. So you don't have an opportunity to cross-examine unless you have a Franks hearing. But those are kind of a special situation. But normally, the whole question on a review of a search warrant is, could the magistrate reasonably determine from the affidavit that was presented that there was probable cause?
Does the word testimonial have any specific meaning, and is it the same in for purposes of a suppression hearing as it would be for purposes of a trial where the state bears the burden to prove the elements of the offense?
If we assume the Confrontation Clause applies, I would say the answer would be no. But
You need the statement to be testimonial in the prosecution. For purposes of a suppression hearing, the issue is, could the officer pull this person over? Right.
Right.
At trial, the testimonial evidence isn't necessarily where the officer could pull the person over. It's whether the person committed the elements of the offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
So my question then becomes, if you dig a little deeper, is it that this testimony that might be testimonial for purposes of a suppression hearing might not be testimonial for purposes of a trial? Do you follow the distinction?
I think so. The reason I'm having difficulty with that is because the application of the Confrontation Clause after Crawford carries this testimonial analysis with it. If, however, we're talking about, is it testimonial in the sense that the underlying facts are relevant to the issue before the fact finder, then, yeah, there is a distinction, because at the suppression hearing, the belief of the officer is what's tested. So whether he's correct or not in the statement really doesn't matter. When we get to whether or not, if for some reason that was relevant at trial, and if the state offered it, it seems to me the strongest argument that it's not testimonial in that sense is it wasn't offered for the truth, because we don't care whether or not the officer was right or not. And
that's part of what I'm wondering. Is
right.
The word testimonial, does it have a distinct, Is that why sometimes suppression hearings might be viewed differently than your right to confrontation at trial?
It certainly is some of the rationale in the early Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court cases, that distinguish between whether you have a right to confrontation at a pretrial or evidentiary stage. Yes.
Because in Crawford, the substance of the testimony that could not be tested, right, wasn't subject to cross-examination, really was testimony of the elements of the offense.
Well, when we get into the actual trial aspect and there's a confrontation problem, you know, that's exactly right, yeah. In this situation, though, once you get past the suppression, the most, not maybe not most, but at least some of the evidence that goes to the to whether or not there's a reasonable suspicion isn't relevant to guilt or innocence, and so it doesn't come in.
That's right.
So
that goes to my original question. So once you say that he can't cross-examine at the suppression hearing, he never can cross-examine because it's not going to be an issue at trial.
In a statement that's not relevant to guilt and innocence, that's true.
Right. So either you get a right to cross-examine at the suppression hearing, or you never get a right to cross-examine, and your whole concept that it was not a good stop, therefore not good evidence, is gone without giving the guy a right to cross-examine. That's why this case is a little different than the one I gave you on confession. Or there may
right.
be other ones.
Which, by the way, you could not put voluntariness to the jury on confessions. Jackson versus Deno says it has to be a judicial determination.
But you get a
now,
second shot at it.
I'm sorry?
Do you get a second shot at it at trial?
Not really, no. I don't think
once
you do.
Once you get the suppression, that's gone.
You have the difference between whether or not it's voluntary and whether or not it's reliable. Reliability is for the jury. Voluntariness is for the court.
Right. If a jury were to decide this case based upon whether or not this defendant was properly stopped, that would be almost a jury nullification argument rather than
it would.
It really is
right. It's really
separate.
It's
from
really separate.
The elements of the offense.
And that's one of the justifications for not applying confrontation to these pretrial type meetings. And the case law that's developed, at least to date, has not distinguished between the type of evidentiary issue or preliminary type of issue it is. It's just a matter of whether it's at trial or not. And it seems to me Justice Ginsburg's statement in Bullcoming is most revealing of that when she says when the state offered an out-of-court statement, they made the declarant a witness. And when you do that at trial, that triggers the confrontation clause. So it seems to me that it does matter an awful lot what the issues are and who's going to decide them for what purpose. And I think traditionally the U.S. Supreme Court has looked at the trial as being the focus of the confrontation clause and that it doesn't go beyond that. Now,
Trial begin?
I'm sorry?
When does the trial begin?
Well, traditionally, when the jury's sworn, that's when jeopardy attaches.
That's right. So you're saying if the jeopardy hasn't attached, it's not a trial, and therefore confrontation doesn't apply?
I think some state, well, it's a juror, I guess, but some states don't allow counsel to question jurors in voir dire. So, I mean, I've never seen anybody make a confrontation argument out of that, but it's certainly an instance where we deny the defendant, or could, at least, we don't hear, but it could be denied, and no one seems to raise that.
But the jury's not the accuser.
I'm sorry?
That's pretty different.
Yeah, it is. It's a very different situation.
Counsel, your opposing counsel would say, when you look at the variety of cases cited that discuss confrontation at trial, they use the phrase at trial because that's the context of the case presented, that you should not take from that language and lead to an inference that confrontation applies only at trial. How do you respond to that?
Well, certainly the Supreme Court in some of those cases has used language that is not equivocal. Ritchie versus Pennsylvania is a good example of that. But even so, the fact that the confrontation cases have only come up in the context of trial doesn't mean that the right is not limited to the trial.
I would have agreed with you. I mean, I think that Crawford was a sea change in the right of confrontation, and I never would have guessed, based on the history of the cases and the evolution, that we would end up with Crawford. I wouldn't have guessed it, given the prior cases in the 20 to 30 years before then. So I guess my concern is that unless you can show me a case that indicates that it is only at trial, I don't know the answer to this case.
Well, certainly there are. If we don't include the U.S. Supreme Court, there are certainly a lot of cases that hold that that the Confrontation Clause does not apply at suppression hearings. But I think when you look at Crawford itself, it doesn't give any indication that it's trying or has any effect at all on the nature of the right. It has all to do with this procedural aspect of accomplishing that purpose.
That's what it says.
And so why would you think, based on that Crawford changed the nature of the right?
Well, one of the questions asked earlier focused on testimonial. Now, who would have known that testimonial now would be part of the equation, right?
Right.
And of course, the Supreme Court in Crawford said, I'll loosely paraphrase, we're not going to define what testimonial is. We'll let that for the courts, the other courts, the state courts and other federal courts, to figure it out.
Thank you very much.
That's exactly it. So I'm not so sure that your position is already written in concrete by the United States Supreme Court. I think since Crawford, we're trying to find our way.
Well, I think that's true. But I think before you get to the question of testimonial, you have to determine that confrontation actually applies. And if, as I believe, based on the history and various statements of the Supreme Court, it turns on whether it's a trial or not, then if you're not at trial, it doesn't apply, and you never get to whether or not something's testimonial. Now, in this case, if this somehow was relevant at a trial and the state offered it, then I think confrontation clause kicks in, and it would be the only plausible argument, I think. I mean, there are two ways you can do it. You can say it's not testimonial because it wasn't, and the primary purpose wasn't to record prior testimony, and I think we made that argument, and I think it certainly has some weight. But in this kind of a case, the biggest and the best argument is that it wasn't offered for the truth of it. And if it's not offered for the truth of it, even if it's a trial, the Confrontation Clause has nothing to say about it.
Well, is suppression important for a trial?
Well, it depends on the suppression hearing, I suppose. But, yeah, I mean, certainly.
Right.
All evidentiary decisions are important to the trial.
But here, on the suppression, determines really whether the elements are proved and whether the defendant has a right to challenge the elements because these depend on whether or not there was reasonable suspicion or probable cause to stop, right? I mean, this reminds me of the right to counsel. The right to counsel was always viewed as a trial right. Miranda said, hey, it's important before trial because it's gone once that confession is made at the police station.
But we don't require Miranda at stops.
But my point is, you require Miranda at the police station because to the extent that there is a confession at the police station, the trial is ended. I'm overstating that. But that's what Miranda says, that if you don't protect the defendant prior to trial with a right to counsel and tell him what the effect of all that is, what's the point of the trial? It's gone by then because you have the confession. And it seems to me that's what you got here.
I disagree with
that. Well, that's right. I know you do, but I want you to tell me why.
Because
when you got a suppression hearing and you never get a second chance at suppressing.
Well,
it's just like you give it all away at that suppression hearing. You give it all away then.
It's not true that you don't have the right to challenge the evidence. You do. And no,
wait a minute. What evidence? Do you have the right
to challenge the stop? Well, the chemical testing, for instance, can be challenged.
Do you have the right to challenge the stop? Is it unreasonable?
No, you don't have the right to challenge the stop, but you do have the right to challenge the evidence.
You can challenge that the breathalyzer wasn't done right. You can challenge that the blood test doesn't say what it purports to say. You can challenge all of that. But that's only in the second. That's like challenging the confession.
Well, that's true. But again, you reference Miranda. Miranda doesn't deal with the Sixth Amendment. Miranda deals with the Fifth Amendment.
I understand that.
Well, then. And it's not really the right to counsel it's protecting. It's the right to silence.
Counsel, if the Confrontation Clause does not give the right to cross-examination at a suppression hearing, would there be a confrontation violation if a court were to conduct a suppression hearing with live witnesses that denied the opportunity to cross-examine at all?
Well, we have a statute that would prohibit that, I think. But
would there be a constitutional violation?
I don't think there would. And it would be very similar to what happens for search warrants, which is sometimes that's presented as live testimony. The officer will testify rather than doing an affidavit. And once you get past that stage, if you were to challenge it retrospectively, I think probably you'd be limited to the transcript of what the officer told the court. So I think there is a precedent for saying, no, you can't do cross-examination at a suppression hearing. I can't really imagine that we'll ever get to that point, nor should we. But I think constitutionally it wouldn't be a problem.
Right. I'm trying to figure out the contours of this confrontation clause right. What if the court were to hold the suppression hearing outside the presence of the defendant?
Well, that, I think, probably, given the definition of critical stage and so on, I think that would be a violation, but it wouldn't be a violation of confrontation.
That would not be a violation.
It would be a violation of the defendant's right to be present. So, I mean, we get to the same point, I suppose. I do want to talk a little bit about
the Sixth Amendment says in all criminal prosecutions,
right,
be confronted with the witnesses against them.
Right, but prosecution in that context doesn't refer just to confrontation.
It doesn't confer only to trial.
Well,
what
if
it,
you will note that in that amendment, it does include the right to silence, and so voluntariness, which we say cannot be submitted to the jury, is included in that prosecution. I think you have to analyze each of the rights laid out in the Sixth Amendment individually. You have to deal with what the interest of that particular right is and balance it against whatever competing right it is that you're dealing with. And so in my view, that explains why the informant privilege is allowed to trump the confrontation clause. It's because the courts determined, right or wrong, that the interest involved in maintaining the confidentiality of the informant outweighs the interest at stake with the confrontation clause. And we know that that kind of balancing goes on a lot when we're talking about competing interests, especially when both of them have a constitutional underpinning. So
you read in all criminal prosecutions differently depending on which part of the Sixth Amendment is applicable.
That's right. And it seems to me the best example of that is the notice is in there. Well, notice can't be limited totally to the trial alone, because it would be pretty worthless.
But the right to public trial is a Sixth Amendment right, and that's been held to apply to suppression hearings.
True. But when I read Waller, I view that case as primarily resting on the First Amendment, not on the Sixth. There is mention, of course, of reliability, but all the precedent that they use to reach the conclusion they reached is all First Amendment precedent.
Well, it may be, but they also state that the public trial clause applies to suppression hearings.
Yes, they do. They do that. But it seems to me that you cannot take anything that goes to the right to public trial and automatically transfer it into the other rights.
Fair enough.
Because of the implementation of the First Amendment.
And that's why we're here. You know,
well,
which
that's
one
true.
of these things in the Sixth, some can be to pretrial, like in Waller, and some aren't. And
right.
Is this one? And who knows? Now, the Second Circuit said that the confrontation applies at suppression hearings, if I recall correctly. United States versus Clark. Didn't that case touch upon that? Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't recall that.
Okay. I'll take a look.
To my mind,
pretrial hearings.
To my mind, the thing that is so different in this case is if you don't give him confrontation at the suppression, he never can challenge that officer's. Assuming it's testimonial, he never challenges. He never confronts the witness. Here, the officer is dead, but he needn't be dead. He could be out of the office that day. He could be on vacation, and you can bring in this recording at the suppression hearing, right?
What you say is true, but I don't see how that's any different than a search warrant. I mean, this situation doesn't lend itself to a search warrant, but we have that exact same situation. An officer fills out an affidavit or testifies before a magistrate. The magistrate issues the warrant. The police search. They get evidence. There's a motion to suppress. And the question is whether or not there was probable cause. And you can't bring the officer in and cross-examine them, except in a rare instance. I don't see the difference. I realize you do, but
you know, I haven't thought about the search warrant, but I will think about that. Maybe that's wrong.
We'll leave that for another day.
Exactly. I just have to deal with this today.
Yeah, that's right. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
What about the Second Circuit case, Clark? Are you familiar with that?
Well, I know that the Second Circuit in Clark did recognize that the confrontation clause applies in suppression hearings. So, but I do want to address why the search warrant affidavit application process is different than a suppression hearing. What the Supreme Court said in Gerstein was that the affidavit application process can be ex parte. It can be based on hearsay testimony. That's to obtain the warrant. The Supreme Court rejected the idea that the suppression hearing should just be considered akin to the search warrant application process because because it said that the public trial clause applies at a suppression hearing. It, while the warrant application process can be enclosed, closed to the public, suppression hearing cannot.
Why would that matter?
Excuse me?
Why would that matter? The fact that a suppression hearing has to be held in public, why would that indicate that there is a right to cross-examine witnesses?
Well, when in Waller, when it explains why that the public trial clause applies, it refers to the witness testimony that's going to happen at the public in a public hearing. It says that the public that a suppression hearing resembles a trial because witnesses are sworn and testify, and that by having it in public, it encourages witnesses to come forward and discourages perjury. It also says that it's especially important to have a suppression hearing in public because strong pressures, again, I'm quoting, strong pressures are naturally at work on the prosecution's witnesses to justify the propriety of their conduct in obtaining the evidence. So it's not just a First Amendment-based case. It has to do with the defendant's right to actually put these public officials under scrutiny and determine whether a search or seizure or whatever the issue was properly done.
They're not really subject to public scrutiny if they're denied cross-examination any more than the affidavit supporting a search warrant, right? Aren't those two analogous? If we say the Confrontation Clause applies to suppression hearing, don't we necessarily have to say that confrontation applies with respect to a search warrant based on an affidavit?
No, absolutely not. Because they're just two different steps in the whole entire criminal prosecution process. The search warrant process is recognized, it has to be, it's set forth in the Fourth Amendment itself. It has to be supported by probable cause under oath. That's all that the Fourth Amendment requires, okay, for a search warrant to be undertaken or approved. The suppression hearing is different. That's the opportunity to determine, in the case of a search warrant, whether it was properly granted.
See, I see the search warrant situation, respectfully, as a little bit like the officer determining, I think I have enough to pull this person over. Search warrant, of course, you go to court because you're going into someone's home or something else to get evidence, right? But in this instance, it's the officer's observations that are later tested in the suppression hearing. But search warrants can be subject to suppression hearings as well. That's
yes.
The difference. These are both kind of preliminary ways to get evidence, but they can be tested by a suppression hearing later.
Right. They can be tested if there's a substantial basis for concluding that, the statements in the application were intentionally false or reckless. Those can be tested at a suppression hearing. If there's no right to confront, then what would the Frank's Man hearing look like if there's no reason, no ability to actually question the officers about whether they were being honest in their application? And also, I would just emphasize that the search warrant is, again, just a first step that should be distinguished from the suppression hearing, which happens at the end of the criminal prosecution and may ultimately determine the outcome of the case.
Also, can you craft for me, as you're standing here, and I recognize it's putting you on the spot, can you craft for me a rule that requires, as a constitutional mandate, that a defendant has the right to cross-examination in a suppression hearing that also respects the fact that the state does not have to produce confidential informants? Can you state something in general enough language that accommodates both of those?
I think the rule that we request, which is that the right to confrontation applies whenever the exclusionary rule is being litigated, I think that covers it, because I think that the Supreme Court has already explained that the Confrontation Clause is not invoked when a statement is not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And confidential informant statements are not being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. They're being offered for the effect on the listener.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for very good arguments. It's an interesting case, and we'll enjoy working through it a little bit later on today and in the weeks that follow. We are going to conclude the arguments for the day. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will come and talk with the students who choose to remain as we adjourn for the day. Those of you that can stay. She won't talk about the substance of the case, but will, I'm sure, give you a lot of pearls of wisdom about how the court generally operates. The court will meet in closed conference at 1:45. We are adjourned.